In the last couple hours, the White House has come out with a revised version of the travel ban targeting migrants from predominantly Muslim nations. This new version removes citizens from Iraq from the original travel embargo. Good afternoon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the All Things Political segment. Joining us now is Orrin Kass. He's a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Manhattan Institute. His analysis focuses on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policy. He served as the domestic policy director for Mitt Romney's presidential bid. Orrin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me back.
This travel ban and the latest news on it, tell us about this new executive order and how it differs from the first one.
Well, I think, as with a lot of the things the Trump administration has released, it's coming out in bits and pieces. So all of this is still subject to a bit of revision, but it looks like what they've done is taken the initial order and tried to take out the pieces that were most objectionable, both in public opinion and in the courts. So they've removed Iraq from the list, particularly because there are so many Iraqi citizens who the United States owes such a great debt of gratitude to for their work during the U.S.'s activities in Iraq. They have done away with the instant enforcement, which caused all of the problems at airports where people literally in the air when the ban went into effect couldn't come in. So they've, I believe, created about a 10-day grace period now for people to adapt to what's going on. They have gotten rid of the treatment of existing visa holders and green card holders. So if you already have a legal right to be in the U.S. with a visa or a green card, that's not going to be taken away. And then they've gotten rid of the religious test and the special, or religious test might not be the right way of describing it. They had said that for refugees, that religious minorities should be given preference, and they've taken that out. And they've taken out the special treatment of Syrian refugees. So instead now, there is a 90-day ban on new admissions from six countries, which are the initial seven minus Iraq. And there is a 120-day ban on the admission of new refugees. And those periods of time are purportedly to give the government time to figure out how to do a better job vetting people coming from those countries.
Would this one withstand more of a challenge if the courts interfered?
You know, it would be likely to. I think it's a little bit hard to know what courts will actually do in a given situation, especially such a politically charged one. I think a lot of the best legal analysis of the prior executive order said, you know, no matter how bad you might think of it as policy, no matter how unreasonable or downright cruel it might be, it was actually quite within the letter of the law. And the analysis from the Ninth Circuit striking it down pretty much ignored the actual letter of the law. So this is certainly responsive to the biggest criticisms that came up. I think if this were just a standard legal analysis, you would expect it to be upheld. But it's certainly possible that you would have a judge. You know, I think the ACLU has said already they're filing suit against it. It's certainly possible you would have a judge who kind of focuses more on the political context and says that he still wants to try to block it.
Do we have any idea how it could impact national security or how it will play a role in U.S. foreign policy?
Well, you know, I think with respect to national security, the tangible impact is clear. How much value you put on that is a lot harder to know. The tangible impact is that there will be fewer people from these six countries entering the United States over the next 90 days. And there will be fewer refugees entering the United States over the next 120 days. How much value you assign to that as a national security matter depends on whether you recognize entry of such people to be a threat. I think you'd have to say the threat is not zero. It's certainly possible that you could have someone coming in from one of these countries with the intention of committing a terrorist act or doing something else to threaten national security. At the same time, the statistical evidence suggests that there have not been very many people doing that, and so the actual kind of the actual improvement you could expect from national security as a result is not likely to be very high. With respect to foreign policy, you know, I think people will, on the one hand, say this really kind of undermines the U.S. standing in some of these parts of the world. But given what's already happened with the first executive order and everything else that President Trump has said, I don't know that this goes a whole lot farther or does a whole lot more damage. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that there's kind of a domestic audience for this, and that this is one of the things that he campaigned on and said he was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And based on kind of the way our democracy functions, we shouldn't be surprised that is what he's doing. And there are certainly going to be a lot of his supporters in particular who are glad to see him doing it.
We're talking with Orrin Kass. He's a senior fellow at the nonpartisan Manhattan Institute, where he focuses on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policies. And Orrin, journalists and politicians on Capitol Hill and the White House itself were all trying to make sense over the weekend of those accusatory tweets that President Trump blamed former President Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower in New York ahead of the election. FBI Director James Comey asked the Justice Department this weekend to issue a statement refuting Trump's claim, but the department hasn't done so. Could we first talk about FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act? What might have the FISA court granted last fall?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, FISA is something that's been has been in the news as a source of controversy before. It's the court that gives the government the authority to wiretap communications where national security is in focus, and in particular where the communication is with a foreign agent. That's why it's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So you may recall prior fights in Congress over the validity of doing this and the transparency or really the lack of transparency with which courts go ahead and grant, or the FISA court goes ahead and grants those kinds of wiretaps.
Mm-hmm.
In this instance, what President Trump appears to be saying is that the Department of Justice what President Trump is saying is that President Obama tapped his phone. There's no evidence of that as far as anyone can tell, and nor would you expect there to be, because it is not the president, obviously, who goes about tapping phones. The underlying basis that has probably raised this issue and may be true is that it appears that the Department of Justice did go to the FISA court and ask for permission to tap phone conversations involving people within the Trump Organization. And it was reported initially in the past that had been denied. And there was another report right at the time of the election that a follow-up application had been approved. And so now what everyone is running around wondering is, was there in fact an approved order? If so, did they then use it to conduct wiretaps? And if so, who did those wiretaps target and why? And it's kind of an awkward situation for the president, because on the one hand, if he's right, you could say, well, there you go. He was right. Someone was listening in on him. On the other hand, if he's right, that means that the Department of Justice went to a court and showed evidence that he was doing something illegal in contact with foreigners in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So, you know, this is likely to come to light over time, but it's a little bit of a catch-22 for the White House, because if there was a wiretap, it very likely means there was also some very bad behavior.
Is this something we could get to the bottom of fairly quickly, or is this going to take a lot of time to figure out what's going on here?
You know, I think in theory it's something that you could get to the bottom of fairly quickly, because these questions have answers, right? They're either the warrant was granted or it's not. Either a wiretap was set up or it wasn't. Somewhere out there in the files of the federal government, that information exists. The problem is that, in particular, because it's FISA, a lot of it is classified and covered by various provisions that are supposed to prevent it from being released. So it's not simply a matter of kind of finding the right press secretary to call up and asking the right question. One thing people are wondering is that if the president, by starting to talk about this, has effectively declassified it. But as we saw from the Hillary Clinton adventures last year, rules around classification don't tend to be very clear either.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think now you're seeing this starting to play out, where the FBI director has now said, no, please, like, explain that this isn't true. And now you have other people in the Department of Justice saying, well, they won't do that. And are they saying they won't do it or they can't do it? And, you know, I think this will take more time, and likely, you know, Congress will get involved at some point in trying to investigate what exactly is going on.
Let's take a call on this now at 800-642-1234, Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I think I know what's going on just by, you know, President Trump's former statements and his behavior, his assertion about the 3 million fraudulent votes, calling former President Obama a sick, bad man, saying that nothing found. He said nothing found. So nothing found, that sounds like there was something to look at and to see if anything was found. And then the source, they say, might be Breitbart News, and I've seen in grocery store checkouts the National Enquirer has stories every week about how Obama's undermining Trump's presidency. And so if, you know, and in the foreign press, I think it just looks bad that this man who's the president of the United States, to me, in any normal sense of the word, seems rather unhinged and unreliable and, you know, slightly, well, to me, it seems just like bizarre to say these things without a hint of evidence. And former CIA Director James Clapper said it didn't happen. Other people said it didn't happen. There's no evidence. And for him to make this kind of statement, either if it's true, it's horrible. If it's not true, it's the bizarrest assertion ever made by a U.S. president, I think, in at least in my lifetime. I'm 66, and even Nixon, as unhinged as he was, didn't come close to anything like this.
Orrin Cass, what about the impact of right-wing conservative media here in this, in what has come out in these tweets?
Well, I think there's definitely kind of a concerning information flow that we've seen here and in other instances as well, where the news kind of goes straight from social media or a not very reliable news source, either straight into the president's hands or maybe via cable news into the president's hands, and then going back the other way, he doesn't then take that as an opportunity to ask a question of the right person. He just starts talking about it, and that doesn't tend to work out very well. You know, I think one thing that people have been puzzled by here is that it's almost as if President Trump forgot that he's president. I mean, one of the powers that he has would be to, in fact, find out if there had been a FISA court order, and if so, what it was, and what that's all information that he could now get. And so to kind of almost be kind of going to Twitter for legal advice when you're the president of the United States isn't it's just not an especially sensible or rational course if you care about the issues. If your goal is just to stir up a storm and get everybody talking about something for a while, then it's very effective. And both in the campaign trail and now in office, I think we've seen that tends to be his focus and something that he's very good at. It doesn't translate into good governance.
Willem, thanks so much for your call. We're talking with Orrin Cass on this edition of All Things Political. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, outlining conservative policy approaches to poverty, climate change, environmental regulation, and international trade. He's briefed members of Congress, and his writing has been published in a wide variety of news outlets. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. The latest CNN poll finds 55% of Americans say they are at least somewhat concerned by reports that some connected to the Trump campaign had contact with suspected Russian operatives. How do you feel about the issues surrounding Russia? Join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation now with Orrin Cass on this edition of All Things Political here on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Orrin is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank, the Manhattan Institute, where he focuses on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are improper ties with Russia overshadowing major policy issues that the White House should be focused on? What are the policy issues you are concerned with? You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's turn our attention now to Russia. Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself last week from any investigation into Russian meddling in the U.S. presidential election. One piece of the conflict is over these two meetings that Sessions had with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak last year. Let's talk a bit about the ambassador. He's been called a low-key ambassador to the U.S., a consummate diplomat. And during the press conference session held Thursday, at one point, he seemed to badmouth the job of ambassadors.
Most of these ambassadors are pretty gossipy, and they liked this was in the campaign season. But I don't recall any specific political discussions.
What do you make of this off-the-cuff remark?
Well, it's hard to know if it's an off-the-cuff remark or if he is kind of giving a very lawyerly response to avoid discussing what they actually might have talked about. You know, I think this scandal in particular is a confusing one just because, you know, the alternative would have been for Sessions just to say during his confirmation hearing, yes, I think I met with the Russian ambassador twice over the past year. Senators meet with ambassadors, as Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill embarrassedly discovered while attacking Senator Sessions over this. She had met with the Russian ambassador twice in recent years also and just didn't remember. So, you know, the fact that he didn't initially acknowledge it is really what has, I think, caused people to focus on it and wonder if there might have been something more there. But in theory, a senator meeting with any ambassador, including the Russian ambassador, doesn't tend to be especially significant.
Let's take a call now. Matt from Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I think that the guest just pointed out what I wanted to say, but I think this goes more than just for Jeff Sessions. A lot of the people that are being called out, quote-unquote, by the media is and with the implication that they're some type of a clandestine or underhanded meeting with the Russians, once you dig into it, all of these look like they're legitimate either business-type things or government day-to-day routine operations where we talk with foreign dignitaries. And the only reason that Russia is being brought up is because we're trying to whip up some Cold War sentiment, and there's nothing there. So unless we can pull out some smoking gun that says, you know, there's a recording where Trump and Putin are getting together saying, you know, we'll fix the election for you if you do X for us, I think the rest of this is just, it's all political theater.
Orrin?
Well, you know, I think there are a few things that we have to separate out. One is the direct contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia. And there we, you know, one of the highest profile examples we have is former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who resigned after having discussions with Russians, the Russians, and then at least lying to Vice President Pence about it. And, you know, that in some respects mirrors what just happened in the Sessions instance, where you can have a reasonable discussion about whether or not it was appropriate to have those meetings or say actually just having those meetings and acknowledging them is fine. But when you have a repeated pattern of people involved with the Trump campaign saying that they were not having meetings and then it turns out that they did, I think that's something that, you know, to Matt's point, is not a smoking gun, but that keeps the story going and makes people suspicious. The other thing I think is important to remember is that independent of direct contacts between the campaign and the Russians, there's the question of what the Russians were doing on their own in an effort to influence the election. And there, I think there's pretty incontrovertible evidence that Russia did undertake an active effort to disrupt the U.S. campaign, and as far as everyone can tell, try to influence the election in Donald Trump's favor, not by hacking vote totals or anything like that, but by trying to drive the kind of news coverage by the way they used or may have supported the release of hacked emails and so on and so forth. And so those are the kinds of things that have people saying, look, even if no one in the Trump campaign was talking to them about anything, that's still a real problem if you have a foreign government behaving in that way. And that's something that I think, especially in Congress now, you hear increasing focus on saying, given all of this, it's certainly appropriate to have an investigation and find out both the full extent of what Russia may have been up to, and then also get to the bottom of you know, what contacts there were with the campaign, whether there was a FISA warrant, what that was about, and so on and so forth.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for your call. There's another bit of tape I want to listen to during the Sessions press conference last week. During his announcement of his recusal, he said, ambassadors ask for these meetings to push their agenda all the time. Let's take a listen.
I think ambassadors are always out trying to find out things and advance their agenda. Most of the countries that ambassadors I met with, they would lay out the case for Ukraine, would lay out its case, Poland laid out its case, Latvia, Lithuania, Hungary, Japan, Canada, Australia. I met with all of those ambassadors over the year.
So he says there he met with ambassadors from 8 countries last year, all who laid out their country's political situation to him. Would this be a normal meeting schedule for a U.S. senator to have sit-downs with ambassadors from around the world to lay out their political situations?
Well, I think it depends a little bit on where the senator's policy focus is and what committees they sit on and so forth. I think certainly as a member of the Armed Services Committee, that's likely one in which he's going to have more rather than less contact with foreign ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, the idea that ambassadors meet with senators is not surprising or newsworthy in any way.
Let's take another call now. Tim from La Crosse. Hi, Tim.
Hi. First thing, I'd kind of like to get your up or down, yes or no. Do you believe at all if the Obama administration is trying to undermine Trump in any which way or form? Just a yes or no. Do you believe that at all?
Well, there is no longer any such thing as an Obama administration. I think it's certainly clear that former members of the administration are very publicly in the media trying to oppose a lot of the things that Trump is doing.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. Let's now go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I agree that this is such a bizarre type of situation, and I can remember, you know, a little more than 4 years ago when Lois Lerner was asked to testify if the IRS was blocking conservative groups from organizing, and she took the Fifth. And since then we hear about Clinton, or ex-President Clinton, taking money from Russian or Russian satellites to give talks, billions of dollars, and the selling of a U.S. uranium mine to through the Clinton Foundation, getting money through Canada, and it ends up in being owned by Russia. All this stuff is just so bizarre. Why aren't we hearing an actual truth from both sides? And it almost seems like the fact that the liberal media is so one-sided, nobody believes anybody anymore. Thank you.
Oren?
Well, you know, I think one aspect of this that's definitely true is that the perceived, as he said, one-sidedness of the liberal media is leading to a lot of skepticism on the right about a lot of these issues. I think people see differences in the way that the Obama administration was covered and the way that the Trump administration is being covered, and rightfully say, well, it kind of seems like some of these outlets and some of these reporters are kind of prosecuting an agenda. That doesn't mean there's nothing there. You know, I both of these things can be true. It can be true that we have some media sources that are not as impartial as they should be, that didn't go as hard on Obama as they should have. But it can also still be true that there are, throughout the Trump administration, some major problems with the way that they're trying to get set up to govern, and with some of the things that they did during the campaign. And potentially, though I think people are trying to figure it out, with respect to the relationship with Russia. So I think it's important to keep both those ideas in our heads at the same time, that we can be upset that the media was not more effective in the past, and still want them to be doing the best they can to uncover what's going on right now.
Well, let's move on now, Orrin Kass. And by the way, Orrin Kass is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Let's talk a little bit about repeal and replace. Vice President Mike Pence and House Speaker Paul Ryan were in Wisconsin Friday with a message to rally around the forthcoming repeal and replace for the Affordable Care Act. And here is what the vice president said about the Obamacare overhaul.
We're going to give Americans the freedom to buy health insurance that's best for you and end the era of government-mandated health insurance in this country. We're going to let you buy health insurance across state lines the way you buy life insurance, the way you buy car insurance. That's how you bring down the cost of health insurance. You create a national marketplace, and then you get that little lizard, and you get Flo on television. And let them start selling cheaper health insurance to every American. That's the American way.
So is this the big fix to create a more competitive marketplace? And will that make the Affordable Care Act work?
Well, I think that they're talking about components of a replacement. I don't think you would make the Affordable Care Act work by doing those things. You know, the question at the heart of a lot of this health insurance debate is what do we want to call, what do we mean when we say health insurance? You know, do we mean the kind of gold-plated insurance that some employers provide, that public workers often get, that just everything is always covered from the first dollar and you go anywhere you want and you don't have to pay? And that kind of insurance is incredibly expensive. And unfortunately, one of the things that a lot of state regulations have done, but now more so that Obamacare did, was to say pretty much that's the kind of insurance that everybody has to have. And if you do that, it's going to be incredibly expensive. And then people are going to say, well, it's unaffordable, so we also now need the government to provide the funding to buy it. And that has not worked out for a lot of Americans, unfortunately, and it's incredibly expensive. So the alternative isn't to tweak one piece or another piece of the Affordable Care Act. It's to say, actually, we want a different model for our healthcare system, where it's not these gold-plated health plans that always cover everything and no one ever has to pay anything. It's actually something that looks more like real insurance, where, you know, when you go to the doctor for a visit, you probably pay for that. If you need the kind of standard medications that that are not extremely costly, you probably pay for those yourselves. And then if you have a really life-threatening condition or a serious accident or you need something really expensive, that's when your insurance really takes care of it. And if we use that model of insurance, it's much cheaper. It becomes something that the vast majority of people can actually afford on their own. It also gets people focusing on how much healthcare costs, which means that actually getting healthcare will become less expensive. And so it's a whole different direction to take the healthcare system in. And there are some trade-offs. We can talk about what's better or what's worse than the Affordable Care Act in that model. But the idea is that it lets people make more of the choices themselves, and it costs less.
Some Republicans and Democrats were on a mission to track down the House's version of repeal and replace late last week. They were told it was under lock and key in the basement of the Capitol at one point. Lawmakers worked through the weekend on structuring tax credits and how the plan will work for low-income individuals. What do you think about this feverish rewrite behind closed doors and trying to get all GOP on board with it?
Well, I mean, I think there's no question that the process has been a mess. And a big reason that the process has become a mess is that we're used to a system now where the White House drives the policy agenda. You know, once upon a time, big pieces of legislation really started and worked their way through Congress, and Congress was the body that we thought of as making the laws. What has happened in the more recent past is that it's become a very presidential-driven process, meaning that the president and his staff really decide what they want the law to look like, And then sit down and compromise with Congress on the details. And that's very much what you saw with Obamacare in 2009. That's part of the reason it's called Obamacare. But the Trump administration, when they came in, really had not done the preparation for that and didn't really have the personnel in place to run that kind of process. And in their principle, President Trump, they didn't really have someone who's even giving a very clear sense of what direction he wants to go. You know, sometimes he sounds like he's talking like a Republican and saying he wants to see more choice and lower cost, and other times he sounds like he's talking like a Democrat and saying, you know, the big goal here is to make sure that everybody has the same kind of insurance coverage. And you can't necessarily do both of those. So I think Congress is kind of trying to catch up and figure out what it's doing. I think now the White House has kind of tried to jump back in once it got staffed up a little bit. But it's a long, messy process. And even in 2009, you know, it took the Obama White House pretty much a full year to go from inauguration to passing a bill. And so the timeline that they're trying to do it on with the preparation that they've done is a pretty big hurdle.
And remind us how this could get passed. Will some Democrats need to support the plan in order for it to reach the president's desk?
Well, it depends. In the Senate, you typically need 60 votes to break a filibuster and move forward with legislation, and the Republicans don't have 60 votes. But there's something called reconciliation, where for budget-related bills in particular, you can move them through with only 50 votes. The last time anyone out there in the public had to worry about this was last time we did health care reform in 2010, when they were just finishing Obamacare, and then Scott Brown won the special election in Massachusetts, and all of a sudden, Democrats only had 59 votes instead of 60. And so they had to do some parts of Obamacare through reconciliation. And what that means is that now this Senate can also repeal those parts of Obamacare through reconciliation. But one of the reasons that this whole process is so complicated is that now there has to be a whole technical fight about what can and can't be done through reconciliation, and are there some provisions that you could put in for 60 votes but not for 50? And so they have to figure that out and also figure out if there's anything they might get some Democrat support for.
We're talking with Orrin Kass right now. He is a senior fellow with the nonpartisan Manhattan Institute, where he focuses on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policy. And we'd like to add your voice to this All Things Political discussion at 800-642-1234. What are you looking for in the Obamacare repeal? What do you want to see happen to Medicaid? Join in at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation with All Things Political discussion with Warren Kass of the Manhattan Institute. He's a senior fellow focused on energy, the environment, and anti-poverty policy. He was a domestic policy advisor of Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in 2011 and 2012. I want your read on the latest in political developments at 800-642-1234. Join the conversation or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones now with Jason in Mason. John in Mason. Hi, John.
Hi. I just have two comments. One is that if this was the Democratic Party that was in power right now, and all this dealing with the Russians and everything, the side that voted for Trump would be in an uproar and demand getting to the bottom of it. It should be, you know, it shouldn't matter who's in office, what party's in office. Anything that's inappropriate should be investigated to the full extent. Comment.
Yeah, and Orrin, what about opening up this investigation? Certainly Democrats are very much in favor of an independent investigation.
Well, I think you have, you know, I think John is right that if this was a Republican, if this was a Democrat administration, you would have the Republicans up in arms. You know, we also saw with President Obama all sorts of troubling issues, even with the Russians in particular, and the sides were in fact exactly reversed. You know, you had Hillary Clinton's infamous reset button. You had Obama caught on a hot mic, telling the Russian prime minister to be patient, and he would have much more flexibility after the election. And of course, Republicans went crazy, and Democrats kind of shrugged. So it is politics as usual that whichever party is in power shrugs when issues come up and the other party demands an investigation. And what you need people in Congress in particular to do is kind of be able to look past that a little bit to figure out what are the most important issues that they need to get beyond the partisanship on. And it is looking likely that this Russian one will be one of those. And you do increasingly hear Republicans saying that there does need to be an investigation, because among other things, it's no fun for them. It's no fun to be a Republican in Congress right now who wants to be talking about something else and instead has to be talking about Russia. So I think that is one of the reasons that you will get an investigation.
Well, John, thank you so much again for your call. And as you mentioned before, finding some common ground, Obamacare is a place where there will be a need to find common ground. And Cynthia in Middleton has a comment on that. Hi, Cynthia. Are you there, Cynthia?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just want to know your thoughts on this idea. I feel that health care is a human rights issue and that cost should not be, you know, like, so if I could afford more health insurance than my neighbor, you know, et cetera, I don't feel that that's fair and that's not even right. And that I feel that health care is a human rights issue and that cost should not play a part in it.
Well, you know, I think it's tempting to pick something like health care that we really care about and say that we don't want to think about cost, but the reality is that the cost is always going to be there, and that if we choose to spend more money on healthcare, it means we're going to be choosing to spend less money on something else. And a lot of times that means it ends up not being, even for the very same low-income people who we're trying to help, we might not be helping them as effectively as we can. So, you know, I think healthcare is a perfect example of this, where I spend a lot of time looking at how we spend money in our safety net. You know, we spend more than $1 trillion a year trying to help low-income households. And at this point, more than half of that goes to Medicaid. And that's because for 40 years now, almost every increase we've had in support to those groups has been health care and increases in Medicaid, in part because people like Cynthia say cost shouldn't be an issue. Well, that's fine, but what that means now is that we have not been investing at all in helping with housing, with transportation, with education, with training. All of those other things fall by the wayside if you say cost doesn't matter, we're always going to spend money on health care. And that turns out not to be how low-income households want to spend their own money, and it turns out not actually to deliver very good results. So we know, for instance, that even as we put more and more money into Medicaid, when we study the results, we find we're not actually getting that many improvements in the physical health of the people who we're trying to give the benefits to. So I agree that it's certainly important to recognize that healthcare matters and that we need to make sure people have access to healthcare. But if we don't pay attention to cost, we're going to end up spending an awful lot of money on ways that are not the best way to help people.
Cynthia, thanks so much for your call. Oren, will Medicaid expansion be a sticking point for this repeal and replace legislation?
You know, it certainly could be, because the nature of politics is that once you give something to someone, it's incredibly difficult to take it away. And so all of those states that expanded Medicaid have added new people to the Medicaid rolls, and it's a very politically potent issue to say or to ask, are you suggesting taking coverage away from those people? The reality is that, you know, we now have several years of good data looking at what has actually happened since we expanded Medicaid. And what we've found is that in the states that we expanded Medicaid in, we didn't get the public health benefits we thought we would. In fact, nationwide, mortality rates have gone up since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, and they've actually gone up faster in the states that did expand Medicaid. So this goes back again to Cynthia's point about, you know, should cost matter? Well, there are trade-offs. We only have so many doctors in this country, for instance. If you say one group is going to get more care, that likely means other people are getting a little bit less care. If you tell everybody, don't worry, whatever you do, you always have health care, they're not necessarily going to make healthier choices as a result. And so I think it's really important to focus on the actual outcomes which we want, which is healthier people, more prosperous households, and ask what policies are going to get us to there. And the answer is typically not just spend money on Medicaid, just spend money on something that's called insurance, even when a lot of times it's not bringing better health.
Let's talk a little bit about the budget. President Trump outlined his budget proposal last week in very broad strokes, and in these top-line numbers there was already a battle brewing. The president's proposed cuts to the State Department have moved Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to declare the package dead on arrival. What can we glean so far in this early budget process?
Well, I think there's a common pattern to how Trump has done most things, both in the campaign and now in office, which is to start with an incredibly aggressive and controversial opening bid and assume that then you'll end up with something a little bit less than that. So I think the administration probably went out of its way to find as many aggressive and controversial cuts as it could, put them all in the initial proposal, and then be prepared to compromise on a lot of them. So you'll probably see some of that spending go back into the budget. On the other hand, I think, you know, there's clearly a strong commitment to trying to cut down in a bunch of these areas and to reduce staff levels and to reduce cost. And that's a valid policy approach that is going to get debated in the Congress.
And the House is expected to vote on a defense appropriations bill this week. It's not expected to include the supplemental spending request the White House wants, and it's not expected to reflect the $603 billion defense spending plan that President Trump laid out last week. What are the lines in the sand here over defense spending?
Well, I think this is a place where a pretty sharp divide between President Trump and congressional Republicans is going to emerge, which is that a lot of Republicans in Congress were elected based on being budget hawks, based on being very concerned about deficits and saying if you're going to raise spending, you have to cut spending somewhere else, and that we have to bring spending down to reduce our deficit. President Trump was elected on a message of essentially not caring at all about any of that. And so with something like his defense spending increase, that really reflects that kind of approach of, you know what, it doesn't matter if that spending goes straight into a deficit. That's what I want to do. And I think Republicans in Congress are going to say, this needs to be paid for somehow. And so, you know, at the end of the day, spending bills have to originate in Congress and then make their way to the White House to be signed. You could, in theory, get to a situation of kind of a government shutdown fight where Congress is sending budgets to Trump and he's refusing to sign them because they don't have the defense spending that he wants. But that, I think it would be surprising to get to that point, given that at the end of the day, on a lot of issues, these guys are on the same side and trying to keep the same priorities moving forward.
We're talking with Orrin Kass right now, senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank, the Manhattan Institute. On this edition of All Things Political, you can add your voice at 800-642-1234. What issues are impacting you? What issues do you see in the political cycle we've been through in the last, whether it be 48 hours last week or even today with the travel ban, newly issued travel ban? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Jessica from Wind Lake, what is on your mind today? Jessica?
Hi. I wanted to say that I see social Darwinism being implemented on our society, even though historically it has never worked and it has put people into mass poverty and it has been a mass failure in the past. You want to talk about repeal and replace? They want to repeal people's insurance and replace it with nothing, basically. I mean, we're talking about pregnant women who are on their own on Medicaid. Let's cut that. Let's see those pregnant women not have prenatal care and not have a right to deliver their child with a doctor.
why don't we go down to third world country poverty levels and, you know, the infant mortality rate? Let's just jack that up because we want to get rid of Medicaid because we're pro-life, but these people who are poor don't matter to us.
And Oren, what does it look like right now with this legislation in terms of Medicaid? As Jessica is implying that it would cut low income women who are pregnant.
Yeah, unfortunately, Jessica doesn't quite have the right information about that. It's not true that Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid coverage for pregnant women. And it's not true that anything the Republicans are talking about would repeal that coverage. Pregnant women and children generally are covered by Medicaid already under prior expansions that were supported by Republicans and Democrats. And their coverage has not gone up since Obamacare went into effect, and their coverage would not go away if you repealed Obamacare. So I think that's an example where people kind of get very caught up in assuming this idea that kind of, well, if Republicans aren't in favor of kind of more spending for everybody, they must be kind of excited to target the most vulnerable populations. And that's just not true. I think Republicans, to almost anyone you asked, would say that they completely agree that you need to make sure especially pregnant women and young children are covered. The question is more, what do you do with able-bodied adults who on the one hand, can potentially be earning money and purchasing their own health insurance, and on the flip side, tend to get the least benefit from insurance that we might provide through the government. You know, this idea that it's social Darwinism or that we're going back to third world types of standards is just false. We're going back to, in the worst case, if you repealed and replaced with nothing, you would go back to the world of, say, 2009 or the 2000s or the 1990s. These are periods of time that most Americans recall quite fondly, and certainly there are improvements to be made, but America's biggest problem was not that there was no health care available.
It seems like President Trump's speech to Congress has been a world away from where we are today, but it happened, and last week received mostly good reviews for his first speech to Congress. What did you make of the president's speech, and if certainly was a different tone than we were used to getting from Trump, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose it was. He seems to practiced reading from the teleprompter a little bit, but in a lot of ways it was very consistent with what we've seen, which was just a lack of substance. There were no real clear policy priorities laid out or plans laid out. It wasn't clear what trade-offs he was thinking about making. It wasn't even clear what arguments he was making about how he wants things to be. He was pretty much just saying, here's a problem, and I promise to fix it, and we can do it all together. So I guess that means he was sounding like a regular politician, but it certainly didn't seem like he had turned the corner and was ready to govern responsibly. And since then, we've seen it's pretty clear he hadn't even made any progress on kind of keeping things under control.
And really quickly, because you live and breathe policy, Oren, what are you watching for here in terms of policy play out here over the next few weeks?
Well, I think this question of whether they can actually get a health care reform proposal onto the table is going to be critically important, because everything else is being held up until that happens. For me, I'm watching most closely to see what happens within the executive agencies, because there's an awful lot that an administration can do without legislation, and that's why you see them taking a lot of action on issues like immigration, on issue like energy and the environment, increasingly I think trade, which is another area where the president has a tremendous amount of authority. Those are the kinds of things that are likely to move faster. They're the kinds of things that Trump showed during the campaign he really cared about, and so there are places where we could see a lot of movement.
Oren, thanks for spending time with us this hour. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oren Cass is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank, the Manhattan Institute. He focuses on conservative policy approaches on poverty, climate change, environmental regulation, and international trade. And his work has been published in a wide variety of media outlets. Stay with us after the news. We'll look at the power of books to change our life with New York Times best-selling author Will Schwalbe and Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show. We had on-air production help today from Chris Molina and technical direction from Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.